beginning to rise in a sky that was the same slick dark gray as the highway. The fields stretched away, stiff and weedy, on either side.
"Where are we going?" Mr. Shortley asked for the first time.
Mrs. Shortley sat with one foot on a packing box so that her knee was pushed into her stomach. Mr. Shortley's elbow was almost under her nose, and Sarah May's bare left foot was sticking over the front seat, touching her ear.
"Where are we going?"
Mr. Shortley repeated, and when she didn't answer again, he turned and looked at her. Fierce heat seemed to be swelling slowly and fully into her face, as if it were welling up now for a final assault. She was sitting in an erect way in spite of the fact that one leg was twisted under her and one knee was almost into her neck. But there was a peculiar lack of light in her icy blue eyes. All the vision in them might have been turned around, looking inside her. She suddenly grabbed Mr. Shortley's elbow and Sarah May's foot at the same time and began to tug and pull on them as if she were trying to fit the two extra limbs onto herself. Mr. Shortley began to curse and quickly stopped the car, and Sarah May yelled to quit, but Mrs. Shortley apparently intended to rearrange the whole car at once. She thrashed forward and backward, clutching at everything she could get her hands on and hugging it to herself. Mr. Shortley's head, Sarah May's leg, the cat, a wad of white bedding, her own big moon-like knee. Then all at once her fierce expression faded into a look of astonishment, and her grip on what she had loosened. One of her eyes drew near to the other and seemed to collapse quietly, and she was still. The two girls, who didn't know what had happened to her, began to say, "Where we going, Ma? Where we going?" They thought she was playing a joke, and that their father, staring straight ahead at her, was imitating a dead man. They didn't know that she had had a great experience, or ever been displaced in the world from all that belonged to her. They were frightened by the gray slick road before them, and they kept repeating in higher and higher voices, "Where we going, Ma? Where we going?" While their mother, her huge body rolled back still against the seat, and her eyes, like blue painted glass, seemed to contemplate for the first time the tremendous frontiers of her true country.
2.
"Well," Mrs. McIntyre said to the old Negro, "we can get along without them. We've seen them come and seen them go, black and white."
She was standing in the calf barn while he cleaned it, and she held a rake in her hand and now and then pulled a corn cob from a corner or pointed to a soggy spot that he had missed. When she discovered the Shortleys were gone, she was delighted, as it meant she wouldn't have to fire them. The people she hired always left her, because they were that kind of people. Of all the families she had had, the Shortleys were the best, if she didn't count the displaced person. They had been not quite trash. Mrs. Shortley was a good woman, and she would miss her. But as the judge used to say, you couldn't have your pie and eat it too, and she was satisfied with the DP.
"We've seen them come and seen them go," she repeated with satisfaction.
"And me and you," the old man said, stooping to drag his hoe under a feed rack, "is still here."
She caught exactly what he meant her to catch in his tone. Bars of sunlight fell from the cracked ceiling across his back and cut him in three distinct parts. She watched his long hands clenched around the hoe and his crooked old profile pushed close to them. "You might have been here before I was," she said to herself, "but it's mighty likely I'll be here when you're gone."
"I've spent half my life fooling with worthless people," she said in a severe voice, "but now I'm through."
"Black and white," he said, "is the same."
"I am through," she repeated, and gave her dark smock that she had thrown over her shoulders like a cape a quick snatch at the neck. She had on a broad-brimmed black straw hat that had cost her $20 20 years ago, and that she used now for a sun hat. "Money is the root of all evil," she said. "The judge said so every day. He said he deplored money. He said the reason you niggers were so uppity was because there was so much money in circulation.
The old Negro had known the judge. Judge say he longed for the day when he'd be too poor to pay a nigger to work. He said, say when that day come, the world be back on its feet.
She leaned forward, her hands on her hips and her neck stretched, and said, well, that day has almost come around here, and I'm telling each and every one of you, you better look sharp. I don't have to put up with foolishness anymore. I have somebody now who has to work.
The old man knew when to answer and when not. At length, he said, we seen him come and we seen him go.
However, the Shortleys were not the worst by far, she said. I well remember those Garretts.
Days before them Collinses, he said.
No, before the Ringfields.
Sweet Lord, them Ringfields, he murmured.
None of that kind want to work, she said.
We've seen them come and we've seen them go, he said, as if this were a refrain. But we ain't never had one before, he said, bending himself up until he faced her, like what we got now.
He was cinnamon-colored with eyes that were so blurred with age that they seemed to be hung behind cobwebs. She gave him an intense stare and held it until, lowering his hands on the hoe, he bent down again and dragged a pile of shavings alongside the wheelbarrow. She said stiffly, he can wash out that barn in the time it took Mr. Shortley to make up his mind he had to do it.
He from Pole, the old man muttered.
From Poland.
And Pole, it ain't like it is here, he said. They got different ways of doing.
And he began to mumble unintelligibly. What are you saying? She said. If you have anything to say about him, say it and say it aloud. He was silent, bending his knees precariously and edging the rake along the underside of the trough. If you know anything he's done that he shouldn't, I expect you to report it to me, she said.
It won't like it was what he should ought or oughtn't, he muttered. It was like what nobody else don't do.
You don't have anything against him, she said shortly, and he's here to stay.
We ain't never had one like him before, is all, he murmured, and gave his polite laugh.
Times are changing, she said. Do you know what's happening to this world? It's swelling up. It's getting so full of people that only the smart, thrifty, energetic ones are going to survive. And she tapped the words smart, thrifty, and energetic out on the palm of her hand. Through the far end of the stall, she could see down the road to where the displaced person was standing in the open barn door, with the green hose in his hand. There was a certain stiffness about his figure that seemed to make it necessary for her to approach him slowly, even in her thoughts. She had decided this was because she couldn't hold an easy conversation with him. Whenever she said anything to him, she found herself shouting and nodding extravagantly, and she would be conscious that one of the Negroes was leaning behind the nearest shed, watching. No, indeed, she said, sitting down on one of the feed racks and folding her arms. I've made up my mind that I've had enough trashy people on this place to last me a lifetime, and I'm not going to spend my last years fooling with Shortleys and Ringfields and Collins when the world is full of people who have to work.
How come there's so many extra?
He asked. People are selfish, she said. They have too many children. There's no sense in it anymore. He had picked up the wheelbarrow handles and was backing out the door, and he paused, half in the sunlight and half out, and stood there chewing his gums as if he had forgotten which direction he wanted to move in. What you colored people don't realize, she said, is that I'm the one around here who holds all the strings together. If you don't work, I don't make any money, and I can't pay you. You're all dependent on me, but you each and everyone act like the shoe is on the other foot. It was not possible to tell from his face if he heard her. Finally, he backed out with the wheelbarrow.
Judge say the devil he know is better than the devil he don't, he said in a clear mutter, and turned and trundled off.
She got up and followed him, a deep vertical pit appearing suddenly in the center of her forehead, just under the red bangs. The judge has long since ceased to pay the bills around here, she called in a piercing voice.
He was the only one of her Negroes who had known the judge, and he thought this gave him title. He had had a low opinion of Mr. Crooms and Mr. McIntyre, her other husbands, and in his veiled, polite way, he had congratulated her after each of her divorces. When he thought it necessary, he would work under a window where he knew she was sitting and talk to himself, a careful roundabout discussion, question and answer, and then refrain. Once she had got up silently and slammed the window down so hard that he had fallen backwards off his feet. Or occasionally he spoke with the peacock. The cock would follow him around the place, his steady eye on the ear of corn that stuck up from the old man's back pocket, or he would sit near him and pick himself. Once from the open kitchen door she had heard him say to the bird,
I remember when it was 20 of you walking about this place, and now it's only you and two hens.
Crooms, it was 12. McIntyre's 5. You and two hens now.
And that time she had stepped out of the door onto the porch and said, Mr. Crooms and Mr. McIntyre, and I don't want to hear you call either of them anything else again. And you can understand this, when that pea chicken dies, there won't be any replacements. She kept the peacock only out of a superstitious fear of annoying the judge in his grave. He had liked to see them walking around the place, for he said they made him feel rich. Of her three husbands, the judge was the one most present to her, although he was the only one she had buried. He was in the family graveyard, a little space fenced in the middle of the back cornfield, with his mother and father and grandfather and three great-aunts and two infant cousins. Mr. Crooms, her second, was 40 miles away in the state asylum, and Mr. McIntyre, her last, was intoxicated, she supposed, in some hotel room in Florida. But the judge, sunk in the cornfield with his family, was always at home. She had married him when he was an old man, and because of his money, but there had been another reason that she would not admit then, even to herself. She had liked him. He was a dirty, snuff-dipping courthouse figure, famous all over the county for being rich, who wore high-top shoes, a string tie, a gray suit with a black stripe in it, and a yellowed Panama hat, winter and summer. His teeth and hair were tobacco-colored, and his face a clay pink, pitted and tracked with mysterious prehistoric-looking marks, as if he had been unearthed among fossils. There had been a peculiar odor about him of sweaty, fondled bills, but he never carried money on him or had a nickel to show. She was his secretary for a few months, and the old man with his sharp eye had seen at once that here was a woman who admired him for himself. The 3 years that he lived after they married were the happiest and most prosperous of Mrs. McIntyre's life. But when he died, his estate proved to be bankrupt. He left her a mortgaged house and 50 acres that he had managed to cut the timber off before he died. It was as if, as the final triumph of a successful life, he had been able to take everything with him. But she had survived. She had survived a succession of tenant farmers and dairymen that the old man himself would have found hard to outdo, and she had been able to meet the constant drain of a tribe of moody, unpredictable Negroes, and she had even managed to hold her own against the incidental bloodsuckers, the cattle dealers and lumbermen and the buyers and sellers of anything, who drove up in pieced-together trucks and honked in the yard. She stood slightly reared back with her arms folded under her smock, and a satisfied expression on her face as she watched the displaced person turn off the hose and disappear inside the barn. She was sorry that the poor man had been chased out of Poland and run across Europe and had had to take up in a tenant shack in a strange country, but she had not been responsible for any of this. She had had a hard time herself. She knew what it was to struggle. People ought to have to struggle. Mr. Guizek had probably had everything given to him all the way across Europe and over here. He had probably not had to struggle enough. She had given him a job. She didn't know if he was grateful or not. She didn't know anything about him except that he did the work. The truth was that he was not very real to her yet. He was the kind of miracle that she had seen happen and that she talked about, but that she still didn't believe. She watched as he came out of the barn and motioned to Sulk, who was coming around the back of the lot. He gesticulated and then took something out of his pocket, and the two of them stood looking at it. She started down the lane toward them. The Negro's figure was slack and tall, and he was craning his round head forward in his usual idiotic way. He was a little better than half-witted, but when they were like that, they were always good workers. The judge had said, always hire you a half-witted nigger because they don't have enough sense to stop working. The Pole was gesticulating rapidly. He left something with the colored boy, and then walked off, and before she rounded the turn in the lane, she heard the tractor crank up. He was on his way to the field. The Negro was still hanging there, gaping at whatever he had in his hand. She entered the lot and walked through the barn, looking with approval at the wet, spotless concrete floor. It was only 9:30, and Mr. Shortley had never got anything washed until 11. As she came out at the other end, she saw the Negro moving very slowly in a diagonal path across the road in front of her, his eyes still on what Mr. Guizac had given him. He didn't see her, and he paused and dipped his knees and leaned over his hand, his tongue describing little circles. He had a photograph. He lifted one finger and traced it lightly over the surface of the picture. Then he looked up and saw her and seemed to freeze, his mouth in a half grin, his finger lifted. "Why haven't you gone to the field?" she asked. He raised one foot and opened his mouth wider, while the hand with the photograph edged toward his back pocket. "What's that?" she said. "It ain't nothing," he muttered, and handed it to her automatically. It was a photograph of a girl of about 12 in a white dress. She had blonde hair with a wreath in it, and she looked forward out of light eyes that were bland and composed. "Who is this child?" Mrs. McIntyre asked. "She is cousin," the boy said in a high voice. "Well, what are you doing with it?" she asked. "She's gone marry me," he said in an even higher voice. "Marry you?" she shrieked. "I pays half to get her over here," he said. "I pays him $3 a week. She bigger now. She is cousin. She don't care who she marries. She's so glad to get away from there." The high voice seemed to shoot up like a nervous jet of sound, and then fall flat as he watched her face. Her eyes were the color of blue granite when the glare falls on it, but she was not looking at him. She was looking down the road where the distant sound of the tractor could be heard.
"I don't reckon she's gone come nohow," the boy murmured.
"I'll see that you get every cent of your money back," she said in a toneless voice, and turned and walked off, holding the photograph bent in two. There was nothing about her small, stiff figure to indicate that she was shaken. As soon as she got in the house, she lay down on her bed and shut her eyes and pressed her hand over her heart as if she were trying to keep it in place. Her mouth opened and she made two or three dry little sounds. Then after a minute, she sat up and said aloud, "They're all the same. It's always been like this," and she fell back flat again. 20 years of being beaten and done in, and they even robbed his grave. And remembering that, she began to cry quietly, wiping her eyes every now and then with the hem of her smock. What she had thought of was the angel over the judge's grave. This had been a naked granite cherub that the old man had seen in the city one day in a tombstone store window. He had been taken with it at once, partly because its face reminded him of his wife, and partly because he wanted a genuine work of art over his grave. He had come home with it sitting on the green plush train seat beside him. Mrs. McIntyre had never noticed the resemblance to herself. She had always thought it hideous, but when the herons stole it off the old man's grave, she was shocked and outraged. Mrs. Heron had thought it very pretty and had walked to the graveyard frequently to see it. And when the herons left, the angel left with them all but its toes, for the axe old man Heron had used to break it off with had struck slightly too high. Mrs. McIntyre had never been able to afford to have it replaced. When she had cried all she could, she got up and went into the back hall, a closet-like space that was dark and quiet as a chapel, and sat down on the edge of the judge's black mechanical chair with her elbow on his desk. This was a giant roll-top piece of furniture, pocked with pigeonholes, full of dusty papers. Old bank books and ledgers were stacked in the half-open drawers, and there was a small safe, empty but locked, set like a tabernacle in the center of it. She had left this part of the house unchanged since the old man's time. It was a kind of memorial to him, sacred because he had conducted his business here. With the slightest tilt one way or the other, the chair gave a rusty skeletal groan that sounded something like him when he had complained of his poverty. It had been his first principle to talk as if he were the poorest man in the world, and she followed it, not only because he had, but because it was true. When she sat with her intense, constricted face turned toward the empty safe, she knew there was nobody poorer in the world than she was. She sat motionless at the desk for 10 or 15 minutes, and then, as if she had gained some strength, she got up and got in her car and drove to the cornfield. The road ran through a shadowy pine thicket, and ended on top of a hill that rolled fanwise down and up again in a broad expanse of tasseled green. Mr. Guizac was cutting from the outside of the field in a circular path to the center, where the graveyard was all but hidden by the corn, and she could see him on the high far side of the slope, mounted on the tractor with the cutter and wagon behind him. From time to time he had to get off the tractor and climb in the wagon to spread the silage because the Negro had not arrived. She watched him patiently, standing in front of her black coupe with her arms folded under her smock, while he progressed slowly around the rim of the field, gradually getting close enough for her to wave to him to get down. He stopped the machine and jumped off and came running forward, wiping his red jaw with a piece of grease rag. "I want to talk to you," she said, and beckoned him to the edge of the thicket where it was shady. He took off the cap and followed her, smiling, but his smile faded when she turned and faced him. Her eyebrows, thin and fierce as a spider's leg, had drawn together ominously, and the deep vertical pit had plunged down from under the red bangs into the bridge of her nose. She removed the bent picture from her pocket and handed it to him silently. Then she stepped back and said, "Mr. Guizac, you would bring this poor innocent child over here and try to marry her to a half-witted, thieving, black, stinking nigger. What kind of a monster are you?" He took the photograph with a slowly returning smile.
"My cousin," he said, "she 12 here. First communion. 16 now."
"Monster," she said to herself, and looked at him as if she were seeing him for the first time. His forehead and skull were white, where they had been protected by his cap, but the rest of his face was red and bristled with short yellow hairs. His eyes were like two bright nails behind his gold-rimmed spectacles that had been mended over the nose with haywire. His whole face looked as if it might have been patched together out of several others. "Mr. Guizac," she said, beginning slowly, and then speaking faster until she ended breathless in the middle of a word. "That nigger cannot have a white wife from Europe. You can't talk to a nigger that way. You'll excite him, and besides, it can't be done. Maybe it can be done in Poland, but it can't be done here, and you'll have to stop. It's all foolishness. That nigger don't have a grain of sense, and you'll excite—"
"She in camp 3 year," he said.
"Your cousin," she said in a positive voice, "cannot come over here and marry one of my Negroes."
"She's 16 year, he said, "from Poland. Mama die. Papa die. She wait in camp. 3 camp.
He pulled a wallet from his pocket and fingered through it, and took out another picture of the same girl, a few years older, dressed in something dark and shapeless. She was standing against a wall with a short woman who apparently had no teeth.
"She mama," he said, pointing to the woman. "She die in 2 camp.
"Mr. Guizac," Mrs. McIntyre said,
pushing the picture back at him. "I will not have my niggers upset. I cannot run this place without my niggers. I can run it without you, but not without them. And if you mention this girl to Sulk again, you won't have a job with me. Do you understand?"
His face showed no comprehension. He seemed to be piecing all these words together in his mind to make a thought. Mrs. McIntyre remembered Mrs. Shortley's words.
"He understands everything. He only pretends he don't, so as to do exactly as he pleases."
And her face regained the look of shocked wrath she had begun with.
"I cannot understand how a man who calls himself a Christian," she said, "could bring a poor innocent girl over here and marry her to something like that. I cannot understand it. I cannot."
And she shook her head and looked into the distance with a pained blue gaze. After a second he shrugged and let his arms drop as if he were tired.
"She no care, Black," he said. "She in camp 3 year."
Mrs. McIntyre felt a peculiar weakness behind her knees.
"Mr. Gwizak," she said, "I don't want to have to speak to you about this again. If I do, you'll have to find another place yourself. Do you understand?"
The patched face did not say. She had the impression that he didn't see her there.
"This is my place," she said. "I say who will come here and who won't."
"Yeah,"
he said, and put back on his cap.
"I am not responsible for the world's misery," she said as an afterthought.
"Yeah,"
he said. "You have a good job. You should be grateful to be here," she added. "But I'm not sure you are."
"Yeah,"
he said, and gave his little shrug and turned back to the tractor. She watched him get on and maneuver the machine into the corn again. When he had passed her and rounded the turn, she climbed to the top of the slope and stood with her arms folded and looked out grimly over the field.
"They're all the same," she muttered, "whether they come from Poland or Tennessee. I've handled herons and ringfields and shortleys, and I can handle a Gwizak."
And she narrowed her gaze until it closed entirely around the diminishing figure on the tractor, as if she were watching him through a gun sight. All her life she had been fighting the world's overflow, and now she had it in the form of a pole.
"Oh, just like all the rest of them," she said. "Only smart and thrifty and energetic, but so am I. And this is my place."
And she stood there, a small, black-hatted, black-smocked figure with an aging cherubic face, and folded her arms as if she were equal to anything. But her heart was beating as if some interior violence had already been done to her. She opened her eyes to include the whole field, so that the figure on the tractor was no larger than a grasshopper in her widened view. She stood there for some time. There was a slight breeze, and the corn trembled in great waves on both sides of the slope. The big cutter, with its monotonous roar, continued to shoot it pulverized into the wagon in a steady spurt of fodder. By nightfall, the displaced person would have worked his way around and around until there would be nothing on either side of the two hills but the stubble, and down in the center, risen like a little island, the graveyard, where the judge lay grinning under his desecrated monument. 3. The priest, with his long, bland face supported on one finger, had been talking for 10 minutes about purgatory, while Mrs. McIntyre squinted furiously at him from an opposite chair. They were drinking ginger ale on her front porch, and she had kept rattling the ice in her glass, rattling her beads, rattling her bracelet like an impatient pony jingling its harness. "There is no moral obligation to keep him," she was saying under her breath. "There is absolutely no moral obligation." Suddenly she lurched up and her voice fell across his brogue like a drill into a mechanical saw.
"Listen," she said. "I'm not theological, I'm practical. I want to talk to you about something practical."
"Arr,"
he groaned, grating to a halt.
She had put at least a finger of whiskey in her own ginger ale, so that she would be able to endure his full-length visit. And she sat down awkwardly, finding the chair closer to her than she had expected. "Mr. Gwizek is not satisfactory," she said. The old man raised his eyebrows in mock wonder. "He's extra," she said. "He doesn't fit in. I have to have somebody who fits in." The priest carefully turned his hat on his knees. He had a little trick of waiting a second silently, and then swinging the conversation back into his own paths. He was about 80. She had never known a priest until she had gone to see this one on the business of getting her the displaced person. After he had got her the pole, he had used the business introduction to try to convert her, just as she had supposed he would.
"Give him time," the old man said. "He'll learn to fit in. Where is that beautiful bird of yours?"
he asked, and then said,
"Ah, I see him,"
and stood up and looked out over the lawn, where the peacock and the two hens were stepping at a strained attention, their long necks ruffled, the cock's violent blue and the hen's silver green, glinting in the late afternoon sun.
"Mr. Gwizek,"
Mrs. McIntyre continued, bearing down with a flat, steady voice, "is very efficient. I'll admit that. But he doesn't understand how to get on with my niggers, and they don't like him. I can't have my niggers run off, and I don't like his attitude. He's not in the least grateful for being here." The priest had his hand on the screen door, and he opened it, ready to make his escape.
"Ah, I must be off," he murmured.
"I tell you, if I had a white man who understood the Negroes, I'd have to let Mr. Gwizek go," she said, and stood up again. He turned then and looked her in the face.
"He has nowhere to go," he said.
Then he said, "Dear lady, I know you well enough to know you wouldn't turn him out for a trifle."
And without waiting for an answer, he raised his hand and gave her his blessing in a rumbling voice. She smiled angrily and said,
"I didn't create his situation, of course."
The priest let his eyes wander toward the birds. They had reached the middle of the lawn. The cock stopped suddenly and, curving his neck backwards, he raised his tail and spread it with a shimmering, timbrous noise. Tears of small, pregnant suns floated in a green-gold haze over his head. The priest stood transfixed, his jaw slack. Mrs. McIntyre wondered where she had ever seen such an idiotic old man.
"Christ will come like that," he said in a loud, gay voice, and wiped his hand over his mouth and stood there, gaping.
Mrs. McIntyre's face assumed a set, puritanical expression, and she reddened. Christ in the conversation embarrassed her the way sex had her mother.
"It is not my responsibility that Mr. Gwizek has nowhere to go," she said. "I don't find myself responsible for all the extra people in the world."
The old man didn't seem to hear her. His attention was fixed on the cock, who was taking minute steps backward, his head against the spread tail.
"The transfiguration," he murmured.
She had no idea what he was talking about. "Mr. Gwizek didn't have to come here in the first place," she said, giving him a hard look. The cock lowered his tail and began to pick grass.
"He didn't have to come in the first place," she repeated, emphasizing each word.
The old man smiled absently.
"He came to redeem us," he said,
and blandly reached for her hand and shook it, and said he must go. If Mr. Shortley had not returned a few weeks later, she would have gone out looking for a new man to hire. She had not wanted him back, but when she saw the familiar black automobile drive up the road and stop by the side of the house, she had the feeling that she was the one returning, after a long, miserable trip, to her own place. She realized all at once that it was Mrs. Shortley she had been missing. She had had no one to talk to since Mrs. Shortley left, and she ran to the door, expecting to see her heaving herself up the steps. Mr. Shortley stood there alone. He had on a black felt hat and a shirt with red and blue palm trees designed in it, but the hollows in his long-bitten, blistered face were deeper than they had been a month ago.
"Well," she said, "where's Mrs. Shortley?"
Mr. Shortley didn't say anything. The change in his face seemed to have come from the inside. He looked like a man who had gone for a long time without water.
"She was God's own angel," he said in a loud voice. "She was the sweetest woman in the world."
"Where is she?"
Mrs. McIntyre murmured.
"Dade," he said. "She had herself a stroke on the day she left out of here."
There was a corpse-like composure about his face.
"I figure that pole killed her," he said. "She seen through him from the first. She known he come from the devil. She told me so."
It took Mrs. McIntyre 3 days to get over Mrs. Shortley's death. She told herself that anyone would have thought they were kin. She rehired Mr. Shortley to do farm work, though actually she didn't want him without his wife. She told him she was going to give 30 days' notice to the displaced person at the end of the month, and that then he could have his job back in the dairy. Mr. Shortley preferred the dairy job, but he was willing to wait. He said it would give him some satisfaction to see the pole leave the place, and Mrs. McIntyre said it would give her a great deal of satisfaction. She confessed that she should have been content with the help she had in the first place, and not have been reaching into other parts of the world for it. Mr. Shortley said he had never cared for foreigners since he had been in the First World's War and seen what they were like. He said he had seen all kinds then, but that none of them were like us. He said he recalled the face of one man who had thrown a hand grenade at him, and that the man had had little round eyeglasses exactly like Mr. Guizak's.
"But Mr. Guizak is a Pole. He's not a German," Mrs. McIntyre said.
"It ain't a great deal of difference in them two kinds," Mr. Shortley had explained.
The Negroes were pleased to see Mr. Shortley back. The displaced person had expected them to work as hard as he worked himself. Whereas Mr. Shortley recognized their limitations. He had never been a very good worker himself with Mrs. Shortley to keep him in line. But without her, he was even more forgetful and slow. The pole worked as fiercely as ever and seemed to have no inkling that he was about to be fired. Mrs. McIntyre saw jobs done in a short time that she had thought would never get done at all. Still, she was resolved to get rid of him. The sight of his small, stiff figure moving quickly here and there had come to be the most irritating sight on the place for her, and she felt she had been tricked by the old priest. He had said there was no legal obligation for her to keep the displaced person if he was not satisfactory, but then he had brought up the moral one. She meant to tell him that her moral obligation was to her own people, to Mr. Shortley, who had fought in the World War for his country, and not to Mr. Guizak, who had merely arrived here to take advantage of whatever he could. She felt she must have this out with the priest before she fired the displaced person. When the first of the month came and the priest hadn't called, she put off giving the pole notice for a little longer. Mr. Shortley told himself that he should have known all along that no woman was going to do what she said she was when she said she was. He didn't know how long he could afford to put up with her shilly-shallying. He thought himself that she was going soft and was afraid to turn the pole out for fear he would have a hard time getting another place. He could tell her the truth about this, that if she let him go, in 3 years he would own his own house and have a television aerial sitting on top of it. As a matter of policy, Mr. Shortley began to come to her back door every evening to put certain facts before her.
"A white man sometimes don't get the consideration a nigger gets," he said, "but that don't matter because he's still white. But sometimes," and here he would pause and look off into the distance, "a man that's fought and bled and died in the service of his native land don't get the consideration of one of them like he was fighting. I asked you, is that right?"
When he asked her such questions, he could watch her face and tell he was making an impression. She didn't look too well these days. He noticed lines around her eyes that hadn't been there when he and Mrs. Shortley had been the only white help on the place. Whenever he thought of Mrs. Shortley, he felt his heart go down like an old bucket into a dry well. The old priest kept away as if he had been frightened by his last visit, but finally, seeing that the displaced person had not been fired, he ventured to call again to take up giving Mrs. McIntyre instructions where he remembered leaving them off. She had not asked to be instructed, but he instructed anyway, forcing a little definition of one of the sacraments or of some dogma into each conversation he had, no matter with whom. He sat on her porch, taking no notice of her partly mocking, partly outraged expression, as she sat shaking her foot, waiting for an opportunity to drive a wedge into his talk.
"Four,"
he was saying, as if he spoke of something that had happened yesterday in town.
"When God sent his only begotten Son, Jesus Christ our Lord,"
he slightly bowed his head,
"as a redeemer to mankind, he..."
"Father Flynn," she said in a voice that made him jump, "I want to talk to you about something serious." The skin under the old man's right eye flinched. "As far as I'm concerned," she said, and glared at him fiercely, "Christ was just another D.P. He raised his hands slightly and let them drop on his knees. He murmured as if he were considering this. "I'm going to let that man go," she said. "I don't have any obligation to him. My obligation is to the people who've done something for their country, not to the ones who've just come over to take advantage of what they can get." And she began to talk rapidly, remembering all her arguments. The priest's attention seemed to retire to some private oratory to wait until she got through. Once or twice his gaze roved out onto the lawn as if he were hunting some means of escape, but she didn't stop. She told him how she had been hanging on to this place for 30 years, always just barely making it against people who came from nowhere and were going nowhere, who didn't want anything but an automobile. She said she had found out they were the same whether they came from Poland or Tennessee. When the Guizacs got ready, she said they would not hesitate to leave her. She told him how the people who looked rich were the poorest of all, because they had the most to keep up. She asked him how he thought she paid her feed bills. She told him she would like to have her house done over, but she couldn't afford it. She couldn't even afford to have the monument restored over her husband's grave. She asked him if he would like to guess what her insurance amounted to for the year. Finally, she asked him if he thought she was made of money, and the old man suddenly let out a great ugly bellow, as if this were a comical question. When the visit was over, she felt let down, though she had clearly triumphed over him. She made up her mind now that on the first of the month she would give the displaced person his 30 days' notice, and she told Mr. Shortley so. Mr. Shortley didn't say anything. His wife had been the only woman he was ever acquainted with who was never scared off from doing what she said. She said the pole had been sent by the devil and the priest. Mr. Shortley had no doubt that the priest had got some peculiar control over Mrs. McIntyre, and that before long she would start attending his masses. She looked as if something was wearing her down from the inside. She was thinner and more fidgety and not as sharp as she used to be. She would look at a milk can now and not see how dirty it was, and he had seen her lips move when she was not talking. The pole never did anything the wrong way, but all the same, he was very irritating to her. Mr. Shortley himself did things as he pleased, not always her way, but she didn't seem to notice. She had noticed, though, that the pole and all his family were getting fat. She pointed out to Mr. Shortley that the hollows had come out of their cheeks and that they saved every cent they made.
"Yes'm, and one of these days he'll be able to buy and sell you out,"
Mr. Shortley had ventured to say, and he could tell that the statement had shaken her. "I'm just waiting for the first," she had said. Mr. Shortley waited, too, and the first came and went, and she didn't fire him. He could have told anybody how it would be. He was not a violent man, but he hated to see a woman done in by a foreigner. He felt that that was one thing a man couldn't stand by and see happen. There was no reason Mrs. McIntyre should not fire Mr. Gwizak at once, but she put it off from day to day. She was worried about her bills and about her health. She didn't sleep at night, or when she did, she dreamed about the displaced person. She had never discharged anyone before. They had all left her. One night she dreamed that Mr. Gwizak and his family were moving into her house, and that she was moving in with Mr. Shortley. This was too much for her, and she woke up and didn't sleep again for several nights. And one night she dreamed that the priest came to call, and droned on and on, saying,
"Dear lady, I know your tender heart won't suffer you to turn the poor man out.
Think of the thousands of them. Think of the ovens and the boxcars and the camps and the sick children, and Christ our Lord."
"He's extra and he's upset the balance around here," she said, "and I am a logical, practical woman. And there are no ovens here, and no camps, and no Christ our Lord, and when he leaves, he'll make more money. He'll work at the mill and buy a car, and don't talk to me. All they want is a car."
"The ovens and the boxcars and the sick children," droned the priest, "and our dear Lord."
"Just one too many," she said.
The next morning she made up her mind while she was eating her breakfast that she would give him his notice at once. And she stood up and walked out of the kitchen and down the road with her table napkin still in her hand. Mr. Gwizak was spraying the barn, standing in his sway-backed way with one hand on his hip. He turned off the hose and gave her an impatient kind of attention, as if she were interfering with his work. She had not thought of what she would say to him. She had merely come. She stood in the barn door, looking severely at the wet, spotless floor and the dripping stanchions.
"Ja gut,"
he said.
"Mr. Gwizak," she said, "I can barely meet my obligations now."
Then she said in a louder, stronger voice, emphasizing each word,
"I have bills to pay."
"I too," Mr. Gwizak said. "Much bills. Little money."
And he shrugged. At the other end of the barn, she saw a long, beak-nosed shadow glide like a snake halfway up the sunlit open door and stop. And somewhere behind her, she was aware of a silence where the sound of the Negro's shoveling had come a minute before.
"This is my place," she said angrily. "All of you are extra. Each and every one of you are extra."
"Yeah,"
Mr. Gwizak said, and turned on the hose again. She wiped her mouth with the napkin she had in her hand and walked off, as if she had accomplished what she came for. Mr. Shortley's shadow withdrew from the door, and he leaned against the side of the barn and lit half of a cigarette that he took out of his pocket. There was nothing for him to do now but wait on the hand of God to strike. But he knew one thing. He was not going to wait with his mouth shut. Starting that morning, he began to complain and to state his side of the case to every person he saw, black or white. He complained in the grocery store and at the courthouse and on the street corner, and directly to Mrs. McIntyre herself, for there was nothing underhanded about him. If the Pole could have understood what he had to say, he would have said it to him, too.
"All men was created free and equal," he said to Mrs. McIntyre, "and I risked my life and limb to prove it. Gone over there and fought and bled and died and come on back over here and find out who's got my job, just exactly who I've been fighting. It was a hand grenade come that near to killing me, and I seen who throwed it. A little man with eyeglasses just like his might have bought him at the same store, small world."
And he gave a bitter little laugh. Since he didn't have Mrs. Shortley to do the talking anymore, he had started doing it himself, and had found that he had a gift for it. He had the power of making other people see his logic. He talked a good deal to the Negroes.
"Why don't you go back to Africa?"
he asked Sulk one morning as they were cleaning out the silo.
"That's your country, ain't it?"
"I ain't going there," the boy said. "It might eat me up."
Well, if you behave yourself, it isn't any reason you can't stay here,
Mr. Shortley said kindly, because you didn't run away from nowhere. Your granddaddy was brought. He didn't have a thing to do with coming. It's the people that run away from where they come from that I ain't got any use for.
I never felt no need to travel, the Negro said.
Well, Mr. Shortley said, if I was going to travel again, it would be to either China or Africa. You go to either of them two places and you can tell right away what the difference is between you and them. You go to these other places and the only way you can tell is if they say something, and then you can't always tell because about half of them know the English language. That's where we make our mistake, he said, letting all them people on English. There'd be a heap less trouble if everybody only knew his own language. My wife said knowing two languages was like having eyes in the back of your head. You couldn't put nothing over on her.
You sure couldn't, the boy muttered, and then he added, she was fine. She was so fine. I never known a finer white woman than her.
Mr. Shortley turned in the opposite direction and worked silently for a while. After a few minutes, he leaned up and tapped the colored boy on the shoulder with the handle of his shovel. For a second, he only looked at him while a great deal of meaning gathered in his wet eyes. Then he said softly, revenge is mine, saith the Lord. Mrs. McIntyre found that everybody in town knew Mr. Shortley's version of her business and that everyone was critical of her conduct. She began to understand that she had a moral obligation to fire the Pole, and that she was shirking it because she found it hard to do. She could not stand the increasing guilt any longer, and on a cold Saturday morning she started off after breakfast to fire him. She walked down to the machine shed, where she heard him cranking up the tractor. There was a heavy frost on the ground that made the fields look like the rough backs of sheep. The sun was almost silver, and the woods stuck up like dry bristles on the skyline. The countryside seemed to be receding from the little circle of noise around the shed. Mr. Guizac was squatting on the ground beside the small tractor, putting in a part. Mrs. McIntyre hoped to get the fields turned over while he still had 30 days to work for her. The colored boy was standing by with some tools in his hand, and Mr. Shortley was under the shed about to get up on the large tractor and back it out. She meant to wait until he and the Negro got out of the way before she began her unpleasant duty. She stood watching Mr. Guizac, stamping her feet on the hard ground, for the cold was climbing like a paralysis up her feet and legs. She had on a heavy black coat and a red handkerchief, with her black hat pulled down on top of it to keep the glare out of her eyes. Under the black brim, her face had an abstracted look, and once or twice her lips moved silently. Mr. Guizac shouted over the noise of the tractor for the Negro to hand him a screwdriver, and when he got it, he turned over on his back on the icy ground and reached up under the machine. She could not see his face, only his feet and legs and trunk sticking impudently out from the side of the tractor. He had on rubber boots that were cracked and splashed with mud. He raised one knee and then lowered it and turned himself slightly. Of all the things she resented about him, she resented most that he hadn't left of his own accord. Mr. Shortley had got on the large tractor and was backing it out from under the shed. He seemed to be warmed by it, as if its heat and strength sent impulses up through him that he obeyed instantly. He had headed it toward the small tractor, but he braked it on a slight incline and jumped off and turned back toward the shed. Mrs. McIntyre was looking fixedly at Mr. Guizac's legs lying flat on the ground now. She heard the brake on the large tractor slip, and, looking up, she saw it move forward, calculating its own path. Later she remembered that she had seen the Negro jump silently out of the way, as if a spring in the earth had released him, and that she had seen Mr. Shortley turn his head with incredible slowness and stare silently over his shoulder, and that she had started to shout to the displaced person, but that she had not. She had felt her eyes and Mr. Shortley's eyes and the Negro's eyes come together in one look that froze them in collusion forever. And she had heard the little noise the Pole made as the tractor wheel broke his backbone. The two men ran forward to help, and she fainted. She remembered when she came to, running somewhere, perhaps into the house and out again, but she could not remember what for, or if she had fainted again when she got there. When she finally came back to where the tractors were, the ambulance had arrived. Mr. Guizek's body was covered with the bent bodies of his wife and two children, and by a black one which hung over him, murmuring words she didn't understand. At first she thought this must be the doctor, but then with a feeling of annoyance she recognized the priest, who had come with the ambulance and was slipping something into the crushed man's mouth. After a minute he stood up, and she looked first at his bloody pants leg, and then at his face, which was not averted from her, but was as withdrawn and expressionless as the rest of the countryside. She only stared at him, for she was too shocked by her experience to be quite herself. Her mind was not taking hold of all that was happening. She felt she was in some foreign country where the people bent over the body were natives, and she watched like a stranger while the dead man was carried away in the ambulance. That evening, Mr. Shortley left without notice to look for a new position, and the Negro Sulk was taken with a sudden desire to see more of the world and set off for the southern part of the state. The old man Astor could not work without company. Mrs. McIntyre hardly noticed that she had no help left, for she came down with a nervous affliction and had to go to the hospital. When she came back, she saw that the place would be too much for her to run now, and she turned her cows over to a professional auctioneer, who sold them at a loss, and retired to live on what she had while she tried to save her declining health. A numbness developed in one of her legs, and her hands and head began to jiggle, and eventually she had to stay in bed all the time, with only a colored woman to wait on her. Her eyesight grew steadily worse, and she lost her voice altogether. Not many people remembered to come out to the country to see her, except the old priest. He came regularly once a week with a bag of breadcrumbs, and after he had fed these to the peacock, he would come in and sit by the side of her bed and explain the doctrines of the church.
This has been an HMH audio production of A Good Man Is Hard to Find and Other Stories, written by Flannery O'Connor with an introduction by Lauren Groff, read by Marguerite Gavin. Text copyright 1955 by Flannery O'Connor. Copyright 1954, 1953, 1948 by Flannery O'Connor. Copyright renewed 1983-1981 by Regina O'Connor. Copyright renewed 1976 by Mrs. Edward F. O'Connor. Introduction text copyright 2019 by Lauren Groff. Audio production copyright 2010 by Blackstone Audio Incorporated. Introduction audio production copyright 2019 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing Company. All rights reserved. For information about permission to reproduce selections from this audiobook, please contact trade.permissions@hmhco.com. To learn more about our books, ebooks, and audiobooks, please visit hmhbooks.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.